now for a word from our sponsors, PHL Life Sciences, a division of the Philadelphia Convention and Visitors Bureau. Host your convention or trade show in Philadelphia, one of America's leading life sciences hubs. PHL Life Sciences, the first and only CVB division of its kind, will connect you to the professionals at the forefront of your industry and to a culture you can only find in Philadelphia, a city known for its rich history that's forging a bright future. Philadelphia challenges the expected and defies convention. A world of discovery is waiting. Visit phllife.com to learn more.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the SCIF Meetings podcast. I'm your host, Miguel Neves, the Editor-in-Chief at SCIF Meetings. And in this episode, I have the pleasure of speaking with Thomas Reiser, the Executive Director of the International Society on Thrombosis and Hemostasis. In our conversation, we explore Tom's varied and international career that spans multiple association management roles, including his current role at ISTH, where he started leading a team of five and is now up to 35 members. We look at some of the big changes that he's implemented, including shifting from a congress every 2 years to doing one every year, and also insourcing almost all event-related roles. We discuss the importance of the real role of medical societies, which is ultimately to improve people's lives. We delve into the importance of public-facing initiatives such as World Kidney Day and World Thrombosis Day, both of which Tom was involved in launching. And we talk about how Tom and ISTH works with suppliers as consultants and true partners. Finally, we look at what key trends Tom sees as the biggest challenges and the biggest opportunities in the event and association management world. I hope you enjoy listening to this conversation, and don't forget to check out the other episodes of the SCIF Meetings podcast. If you like what you hear, consider rating the podcast or leaving a short review. And of course, we'd be delighted if you share it with your network. And now onto the episode. Thanks for listening. Hello, everybody. Welcome to this episode of the SCIF Meetings podcast. It's nice to be with you again. And today I am joined by Thomas Reiser, the Executive Director of the International Society on Thrombosis and Hemostasis. Hopefully I said all that right. Tom, welcome to the show. Thank you for being with us today.
You did beautifully, Miguel, and thank you for having me. Good morning, at least good morning from here, from the United States.
Perfect. Tom, we've known each other for a few years. You've been on many stages. You've been involved with many industry events. But for people who don't know you, who've not come across you before, or who want to find out a little bit more about you, I'd love you to talk a little bit about your career. I'd love to start there. And I'd like to start when you first came across the world of events. If you remember that moment, if there's a sort of any kind of story there, maybe it was at university, maybe it was somewhere else. But when did you first sort of become aware of the world of business events?
Yeah, thank you. I mean, yes, we've known each other for a long time. I really value our connection and you as a person and a professional, and really look forward to this discussion. It's a great question. Look, I'm from Vienna, Austria. So Vienna is one of the leading meetings destinations. There's always something going on in Vienna. And even as a small child, I kind of was aware of it. And on top of it, one of our neighbors happened to be the CEO of one of the venues in Vienna, actually the Imperial Palace, the convention center, if you happen to know it, it's beautiful. And I was very early on interested in tourism and hospitality. That's actually also my education. Ultimately, I have a business degree and a hospitality management degree. And completely randomly, right out of school, I had the opportunity to join the European Society of Radiology. It set up its own office in Vienna. I was in the mid-90s or in the early 90s. And I didn't have a job yet. A friend of mine was just hired there and said, hey, we're still looking for people you want to join. And I joined in, and I very quickly really enjoyed what I was doing, except I didn't know what I was doing. That was the funny thing, right? I fell into more of the association and meeting side at the same time. It started more with meetings, and we ran a large meeting. ECR now, the European Congress of Radiology, is one of the largest and most innovative meetings in Europe. So I had the chance to really kind of learn things there and go through the motions. And I really, really enjoyed it. However, and this is the interesting part, because I consider myself less as a meetings professional than an association professional. I frankly couldn't deal with the ups and downs. You work towards a big congress, it happens, everybody's happy, and then it's over, right? And you basically work your way up again to the next one, the next edition. So I went more then into the association side, which provides much more continuity. The meetings are obviously a very important part of associations work. And that's a little bit more my space, if you want. So that's kind of the origins. I can tell you a little bit more about the further career if you want.
Sure, let's go through it. I'd love to get, you know, just a small sample of the different roles that you've
yes.
had, and then take us through to today, if you don't mind.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'll make it quick. So as I said, I started working with ESR, really enjoyed what I was doing, didn't know what it was, but learned about it. And it was like, hey, what I'm doing here is association management. And back in the early 90s, that was not really an established profession in Europe, or a recognized profession, at least. And so I had the opportunity to from a friend of mine, I learned about the association management profession in the United States. And I was absolutely fascinated and learned about the American Society of Association Executive and learned about the company Smith Buckland. Back then it was Smith Buckland Associates and the largest association management company in the world. And I basically just applied and I said, hey, I love what you're doing. I'd love to really learn more about association management. Can it come work for you? Completely naive to think, you know, what that actually all encompasses. But I was lucky enough that they took me in as an intern. I got an H-1B visa, a limited work visa in the United States, went to Washington, D.C. I wanted to go to Chicago where the head office was, but they said, well, we can offer you something in D.C. And I hopped on a plane and came over here, started doing literally copies in the mail room. And then after a couple of years here, they had a worked my way up a little bit, and then an international medical society came to Smith Buckland and they were like, hey, you know, you're the international guy, you know, you kind of know what you're doing, why don't you take it on? And so that was kind of my start really in myself managing associations. So yeah, that was my start actually running associations as part of an association management company. Then had the opportunity to move to Europe, joined another association management company, which ultimately became MCI, and the management with Robin Luckerman. Worked on several medical clients. Obviously, once we joined MCI, a whole new world opened up and grew and developed there. Managed several clients. All meetings were always part of the portfolio, obviously. So done a lot, lots of them. And then in 2000, back in the US, had met my wife. We got married. We moved over to Brussels together. And then in 2011, we said, you know, it's time for us to move on. And we were thinking about where we would go. And then funny enough, so we decided ultimately to go back to the United States. And funny enough, the International Society on Thrombosis and Hemostasis, where I'm still at, was just looking at professionalizing its management. And I had, funny enough, had some connections with ISTH because in the different organizations that I worked with, medically, scientifically, there were connections, and I knew a couple of people. And I was very fortunate to be offered the position. We were five people then. Now we were 35, 36, 37. Can't keep count on it. And I've never looked back. And it's been a wonderful journey with ISTH for the last 13 years.
Wonderful. Well, thanks for taking us through that. So tell me a little bit about what ISTH looks like today. You know, I think our listeners are more on the event side, so we'd love to understand the type of events that you do. But of course, you know, there's a lot more to that. So feel free to go wherever you want to go.
Yeah, we've gone through a very interesting journey as a society. We had a meeting when I started. We had a World Congress every other year and a smaller meeting of our Scientific and Standardization Committee in the odd years. The Congress was no, the other way around. The Congress was in the odd years, and the SSC meetings were in the even years. And then we decided, hey, this all doesn't really make sense. People are getting confused. Which is which? We had all kinds of different structures, prices, everything. We standardized this through a whole strategic meeting assessment, really, over a few years, led by our director of meetings, Lisa Astorga, who did a fantastic job. And in 2019, right before the pandemic, as you can imagine, takes a long time to get this up and running with governance and so on. So in 2019, we started our annual Congress rotation. So we now have an annual Congress every year. I cannot really tell you exactly how it's going to look like now post-pandemic. Before the pandemic, we attracted about 7,000-8,000 people every other year. And now we're probably trending more towards the 6,000 every year. And which is good because that gives us obviously every year a much bigger attendance. And we also set up a global rotation pattern for our meetings. So it's very clear when we're in Western Europe, when we're in North America, and when we are what we call the rest of the world. I know this is very big, but our two main membership groups are in North America and Western Europe. And also through that journey, we went from completely outsourcing every aspect of our meeting to completely insourcing every aspect of our meeting, simply because we have the size, simply because we want the consistency and so on. We've worked with amazing partners outsource in an outsourcing way, but for us, it was a better way to do this internally. In addition, we have one to two educational meetings. They're much smaller, maybe 200 to 300 people a year. And then we support a lot of other meetings that we don't really manage ourselves, but we're just supporting the local partners. That's really it from a meeting side.
So you're the International Society, right?
Yes.
And I think based in the US, based in Washington, D.C. But there's many American societies and American associations and other that have similar sizes, and many are considered also the largest body, the largest association in the world. Is there a big difference in being an international society compared to the American society that's going global, let's say?
So two things. First of all, it's very unusual in our space that we as the ISTH, the International Society, are really the oldest, the most recognized, the biggest, I would argue the most impactful organization in thrombosis and hemostasis, and that's bleeding and clotting. We have a strong American society that is not as large as we are. There's a European society that is primarily focused on the hemophilia side, on the bleeding side. So for us, it's a little bit unusual. But yes, as a truly global organization, it is quite different than an American organization or a European society, for that matter, to go global, because we are set up from our bylaws and everything from a governance point of view, from an operating point of view, as that kind of entity that is really representative and engaging. And that's how we think, that's how our strategic plan is done, and so on. I think that's really the biggest difference.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. So, kind of a fun question, but maybe with a serious angle to it. When you have explained what you do to friends and family that, aren't really involved with societies or the events world, how do you explain it? Are you successful at explaining it, and how do you go about it?
Well, I don't know if I'm successful in explaining this, but I have two basically quick explanations. One, which is the broader one, and that is, we basically help save lives. That's what I truly believe. We are a medical scientific society. We are one degree away from the physicians, the researchers, the allied health professionals who treat the patient. And whatever we do, and with almost everything that we do, we have a very direct impact on patient care. And that's hugely, first of all, it's hugely rewarding. It's an enormous privilege. And it really makes a difference. It really, really makes a difference. If you want to say more practically, I would say the way I would explain it is that we help our constituents, which are, again, the physicians, the researchers, the allied health professionals, to make, if you want to say, make meaningful connections, help create new knowledge and skills to ultimately advance, therapies and treatments for people who suffer from, in our case, bleeding and clotting disorders.
I like that. It's very, very end product focused, right? You're kind of not
trying to.
You're not focused on your day-to-day activities, right, and the events that you plan, but more how those impact the people that come to them, right?
Correct. I mean, I see this as tools to get your mission across, right?
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. And when you look back at your career, you know, you've said you've done lots of different events. Is there one or any that stand out as something that you're really proud of?
So yeah, I mean, I cannot really take full credit for that because it was only a few months after I started my job. But I was a bit involved in ultimately the decision making to go ahead with it, and that was our ISTH 2011 Congress in Kyoto, which was actually the first major international Congress held in Japan after, you may remember, the tsunami and the Fukushima nuclear disaster, and that was very, very special. And I know how much it meant for Japan and the people in Japan. It was a fantastic meeting. Kyoto is an amazing city, and that was very meaningful. If I want to go beyond the congresses, I think what I'm most proud of is having been really very intimately involved in launching two World Health Awareness Days. First World Kidney Day, when I worked with the International Society of Nephrology, and with ISTH, World Thrombosis Day, which actually just celebrated its 10th anniversary last year, because what we're really doing is we're helping raise awareness about thrombosis day, the risks of blood clots, how they can be prevented. That's very meaningful.
And why do you think these world days are so important for you? Is it because you touch the public directly, or is there something else?
I think in both cases, both in kidney disease and even more so in thrombosis and blood clots, is there's so much that can be done to prevent the disease in the first place, or to be aware, be informed, that direct relationship with the patient. What we're creating is informed patients and family members and caregivers, and that really saves lives. And we get letters every year, and it's just so heartwarming where people thank us because of what we've done. They were aware of what to look out for, what to ask, recognize the signs and symptoms, and it allowed them to seek treatment before it became a real health crisis.
So you've obviously been very successful in your career. I think you've listed some great achievements, and fast-tracking your way to leadership, I think, is always excellent to see. Are there kind of key qualities or skills that you think have been important or most important in this journey so far?
Yeah, that's a very good question. First of all, I think, and I've reflected on this actually before we even decided that we wanted to talk, my leadership style has evolved significantly in my career, and I think that's necessary, right? As leaders, you always need to evolve, and you know, remember, I'm coming from a particular culture in Austria that particularly back then has fostered a certain, or was looking for particular leadership skills, and obviously that has all changed. I think it is really the ability to connect people with a cause and motivating them to do things they otherwise may not actually think they could do themselves. And that is both for volunteers and obviously for my colleagues and staff. And I think that's a key element, in particular for associations, because we're working for a mission. So I would say that.
And do you find that, or is part of that transferable to corporations as well?
I would, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you need to do the same thing. I think it's a little bit easy with associations. As I said, I believe we are literally saving lives, or help saving lives. We ourselves, with World Thrombosis Day, we might very well save lives. it has a different meaning than maybe just creating more revenue and more resources or better shareholder value or whatever. I mean, for us, I think that's a bit more impactful.
And when you see companies that have, you know, mission statements and vision statements, is that something that you kind of look at and kind of, I don't know, I guess in some way buy into? Because if you're also applying the same thinking to for-profit companies, then there needs to be a mission there that makes sense, right? Is that something you believe is really there, or do you feel that that's a bit of, I don't know, market washing or something like that?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think what speaks louder than a mission statement or words is actually how a company really represents itself. Yeah, how it shows up, how it acts, how it really shows up. I think that's more important than having a fluffy mission in XYZ. I mean, it's with everything, because also with us as associations. Does it make sense?
Actions are louder than words, I think, is
that's very nicely put.
So what about people or organizations that have sort of helped you in your career? Does anybody or any organization come to mind that's been?
There are too many to count, and certainly different individuals in different stages in my career. And I would say that I sometimes actually don't realize this, how much somebody has actually influenced me or what I've learned from somebody, maybe until a little bit later. And I think they will not necessarily know, although I have to say, I'm making more of an effort to like reach back maybe to people from other parts, earlier parts of my life and reconnect. That is very important for me, the network. And actually share that, because I think you get a little bit of wisdom, if you want, from the various years that you are in the profession, and you're like, wow, this has actually really had an impact on me. And then I would say, generally speaking, and you know this, you know, as well as I do, I think our industry is one that the global association, the global meetings industry, is just one that really is a wonderful network. One organization certainly is ICA, which provides, I think, a wonderful network of both destinations, destination partners, convention centers, and associations increasingly that really work together, exchange, help each other. That's wonderful. And the other one that I have actually joined more recently is the Association Congress Forum, or AC Forum, in Europe. That is a really fantastic peer-to-peer networking group of a limited number of associations, primarily European, but with international outlook, that I've valued tremendously. Generally speaking, I mean, I feel extremely fortunate to have been able to build, I do work on it, this is important to me as well, but to have a wonderful network of peers really from around the world. And I learn from them all the time, I get advice from them, I can speak to them about any topic, anything I need. It's very, I feel very fortunate about that.
Yeah, I'm happy to hear you say that. I think that's a powerful thing to have and to nurture.
Yeah.
Are you ready to celebrate your successes in the world of meetings and events? The Skift Meetings Awards are back for 2024, recognizing the most innovative business events companies across 15 categories, and we want you to be a part of it. Winners will feature on Skift Meetings, sending a clear signal to events professionals around the world that these are partners they can rely on. The final deadline for submissions is June 11th. We encourage you to start your submission today to secure the best entry rates. For more information and to start your submission, head to live.skift.com.
What about the supplier side of the industry, right? Because you must, I've seen you at IMEX, I've seen you at different events, you must get hounded by people trying to sell you something, right? But it's, you know, a necessary part of the industry. And you talked about insourcing a lot with IMEX. What's your sort of advice, I guess, to suppliers that are looking to build relationships in the right way? How should they approach that? Because obviously the world, you know, we need to exist, we need to buy and sell from each other, but there's good ways and bad ways to do that, right?
Also a great question. First of all, I really dislike the word supplier. I would rather prefer a solution partner or a partner and a sector partner, something like this, because I truly feel, and my team feels the same way, that we're working together and that we've had such wonderful relationships and we've been helped so much by our partners that with things that we could have never done ourselves, and it has ultimately allowed us to evolve as an organization as we are today. It is about people. Obviously, you have to have a good product, but it is also about people. And the selling is often a more consultative. The selling that is more effective, in my opinion, is often the more consultative selling that goes through a relationship rather than just the latest flashy brochure or presentation or something else. That's how I see that.
Okay. And do you value, what kind of approaches do you value? Like if somebody wants to connect with you, how does that work? Is that an event? Is that kind of the power of kind of industry events where you get to actually connect with people rather than, through a website or something like that?
That, to me, that is a channel, that's an avenue. I think what is the most important thing is the nature of the connection. The inquiry, the curiosity to learn about somebody else, somebody else's business, somebody else's needs, and then be able to match that with a solution. And yes, I would say in most cases, the one that I feel most relevant for me is meeting in person, but it could be over virtual means as well. We're around the world. Many of our partners that we've worked with over the years are really, in Australia and in Japan and in Europe. It's not always possible to see each other in person, but I have one person that I appreciate so much. You may know her, but I'm not going to mention the name right now. She always touches base with me, and I never feel that there is any selling going on. It's really a fantastic exchange of ideas and knowledge, and she makes connections, or she may have a solution for me. But it's more than a pure sell.
So you value those relationships regardless of where what people are
Tremendously.
doing and what they're working on,
We
etc.
can always learn, right? We can always, and I think our partners have to with a wonderful USP, if you want. They work with tens, hundreds, thousands of clients. The knowledge that they gain from those relationships can come back to us and hugely benefit us. That is enormous.
No, that's a really positive approach. I'm happy you share that with us.
Yeah,
So
wouldn't
let's
see
think.
it any differently.
Excellent. So I want to take sort of a big picture approach now. I want to talk a little bit about trends. I think you're someone who always keeps up with trends and figures out, what's real, what's not, what's actually something worth worrying about, and what's worth getting excited about. What are you seeing up ahead that you're excited about, let's say?
Yeah, it's a difficult question to a degree because everything is so much in flux. So many things are happening. So many things are currently at play. First of all, I think more fundamentally, I think it is really extremely helpful that the way we do business, things are questioned, right? And I think that helps us innovate. That helps us to think differently. That helps us to find new approaches and solutions. Yeah, I think it keeps us on our toes to a degree. So I think that's really, really positive. I think it also forces us to think about what is really most impactful that we do. What are the most important aspects? How can we make a true difference? How can we set ourselves apart? I think one of the big ones, I mean, there's so many. do want to talk about AI separately, because that's obviously a big one. But one is certainly, the, in my opinion, the whole aspect of how, you know, how work has changed. You know, this whole remote working, this hybrid working. I have to be a little careful. My wife is in the commercial real estate sector, so I don't want to say, hey, you know, working from home is the best thing. Look, every organization needs to find out what is best. But I think the pandemic has really taught us that we can do this very, very differently. I think it working from home, working remotely has so many benefits. Reduction of waste of time. Commuting is terrible in most cities still. It helps you build teams more readily. It's not so much focused on who lives within a certain radius. And frankly, it's a huge benefit for individual team members who have the flexibility. Not saying it, working remotely is for everybody, but at least they have the flexibility and are not forced to come to a place of work all the time. So that's I think that's a big one and a good one.
Yeah, that's something we've been looking at a lot at SCIF meetings. I was just thinking, are there big trends, do you feel, impacting associations in terms of, you know, when you think of even ISTH, do you see it being very different in 5-10 years time?
Yes, I mean, first of all, I think every sector has its own, obviously every sector has its own dynamics, right? In our case, it's like what happens with the treatments, what happens with the research, and that is constantly evolving. The value of meetings, particularly in my opinion, is going to be questioned more, but rightly so. So we talked about this before. There's huge value in bringing people together, but our meetings, at least how they used to be managed and planned and formatted and so on, are these still the best formats for creating that interaction when we actually get together physically, and how can that best complement things that we can very easily do virtually anyway? So this continues to be in flux. I think it will continue to shape the dialogue and also how organizations and businesses are going to be successful here. Obviously, sustainability, the whole environmental impact of everything, not just business travel, but, you know, it that's going to impact us and is impacting us already. So, by the way, I have an important comment on that. My personal opinion is very strongly focused on innovation around this. I think that's how we as humankind have just thrived, by finding problems to overcome, finding solutions to overcome problems, rather than, and I think this is a little bit of what's going on in our field, is it almost feels bad that you travel. It almost feels like it's a negative, and you're almost scolded or penalized for something. I think it is really about innovation on how we can overcome this. You know, is it cleaner fuels? Is it you know, other energy sources, things like that? But it should not be, hey, we don't do something anymore necessarily. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I think it's the, would you see yourself as someone who believes that technology will find a solution in a way?
I would say people will find a solution, and they're going to apply, hopefully, technology in innovative ways, and research and science, and will come up with solutions. But I think we need to move, ideally we need to move forward. Otherwise, you know, when we talk about sustainability, which is another huge topic, it's obviously not just the environment. It's also, you know, education, it's healthy living, it is, you know, business, prospering in business and so on. So it is, you know, we got to be approaching this slightly differently, of maybe finding incentives, finding, again, new approaches to it. But it's also obviously it's a whole, it's not just the sector, you know, it's you know, an all hands on deck effort across everything. And ideally, of course, all countries, because we're all living on the same planet.
Absolutely. You already mentioned AI. Is that something that is a big part of your thinking in your role at the moment?
It's an increasing part of the thinking. And I think it holds tremendous promise. It has also already evolved very quickly and what it can do. And we're all trying to figure out how can we best employ it and use it. I think for me, the really exciting thing is the prospect of cutting down on low value activities, focus more on the high value things, the building relationships, the creating value in innovative ways. Also the opportunity through AI to inject different approaches of thinking or new perspectives. I think all of that is super, super exciting. It's very challenging, I think, for individual organizations to try to find an AI approach. I think what's gonna happen, what's gonna have to happen is that our partners, suppliers, as you indicated, our sector partners, our solution partners, really are starting to build AI into the very tools that we use on a daily basis. You probably remember the whole discussion that happened probably many years ago about whether organizations start building their own AMS systems or their own program and Congress program management systems, or whether you go and get something off the shelf. We are not in this business. Yeah, there might be some, obviously there are some associations that are in the technology business and the AI business, but most organizations are not. That's not our core strength. So we need to look at partners to actually inject AI into the very solutions that we need. That's how I see it at this point.
One of the areas that I've been discussing with, you know, a common friend of ours, Kai Troll, for example, at a couple of webinars, is AI with associations. And one of the ideas that we discussed was this thought that associations and societies have huge libraries of content. You know, you have sessions from different congresses, you have maybe white papers, you have all this content. And AI could be a very smart way to put that content together and make it easy for members to interact with that content, right? So rather than watching a 2-hour recorded session, they could get a 5-minute summary or whatever it is that AI can do. Is that part of your thinking? Because I could see a massive advantage for associations there having all this content as part of their existence, right?
Yeah. Oh, it's there already. I mean, it's there already. I mean, obviously, most organizations are already putting all their content together, and actually more and more platforms that are being used, like our ISTH Academy, already has AI built in to help, actually, you know, through algorithms, and it's all, you know, a much different language that I can speak, but to start making suggestions, to pull things out and combine things into like collections and so on. And that's what I meant before to say, look, yes, this is exactly what we're looking for, and I think will help tremendously. But the association itself is probably not best equipped to actually do it themselves. So who can be the partners that actually help us? And as we just discussed, AI has already evolved so quickly in just a year. You know, who's going to really be able, from an association point of view, unless it's just your core business, who's going to really be able to keep up with all the constant evolutions and advances of this thing? There are obviously huge questions still out there about, you know, copyright and the accuracy of some of the things. We've been looking at it from a guideline development point of view, because there's so much data that you have to comb through to actually get to developing a guideline. I mean, that would be a huge benefit. So there are enormous applicabilities. You mentioned before, you know, what do you see as the trends? What is exciting for you, but also kind of like what keeps you a little bit awake? Obviously, the nefarious use of AI, you know, keeps me awake and keeps, I think, everyone awake to a degree. We can't control that, but it's certainly, you know, worrying.
Yeah. What about membership and, you know, kind of the reasons to be part of ISTH? Do you think that those will change, and do you think that AI will have sort of impact on that?
That's also a very good question. Look, I think membership has been changing, and that's a generational thing. That is also what is available currently. Obviously, the more things are available outside of an organization or a network or whatever, I think the traditional membership value is diminishing. So and we are looking at this greatly, at what can we do to continue to enhance the connections between our members and in an authoritative way. Is that a word, authoritative?
Yes.
Okay, in an authoritative way, so that you know, hey, this is really a network of people that know what they're talking about, and the information that comes out of an organization like ISTH you can really trust. I think that remains a key element, and to actually help our members enhance their visibility, enhance their careers, give them new opportunities to engage and be part of, you know, programming, faculty, and so on. That's what we are looking at right now specifically. And there may be already AI tools that help even more with that. Again, I think there's going to be a huge opportunity for partners to come up with amazing solutions that you could hopefully just plug in and use.
It does sound like if you had an ISTH bot trained only on your content, you could offer a lot of that, right? You could give people advice. You could give people, you know, where they should be looking for certain content or something like that.
Yeah.
Some interesting potential there.
Totally. And this is an area, I mean, we're watching this space very carefully, and various team members constantly attend sessions and events to learn as much as possible of what's out there, how can we apply that. Huge opportunities.
You mentioned already challenges, what's keeping you up at night, AI being one of them. Anything else kind of a big concern at the moment?
Well, I think, look, there are things that we can control, and there are things that we cannot control. I mean, obviously, the world is, or at least appears to be, a little bit more fragile or unstable as maybe just a few years ago. I don't know whether you listened in on this ASAE webinar last Friday, that 2024 is the largest year of election year ever in history, and most people ever are going to go to the polls this year. So, you know, polarization of politics is a huge one. And actually that shows up it's not just something that you say, okay, it happens in the world, but it shows up in your staff, but it can show up in your staff. It can show up in your board. I mean, that is really an interesting dynamic. We talked a little bit about AI, the more nefarious use, as I like to call it, about AI. I'm not sure it's going to eradicate civilization, but I mean, there's a lot of bad things that can be done with this. The human is very innovative in so many good ways, but always also finds a way to be you know, screwing things up at the same time. What keeps me awake of things that we can control maybe a little bit more is certainly remaining relevant as an organization. So many things change. You know, take medicine. You know, it was very compartmentalized. You know, hematology did this, and hepatology did something else, and nephrology did something else, and now this is much more integrated and much more cross disciplinary and so on. So that's a very new dynamic, and how to best partner and collaborate, but retain your own, you know, area of influence if you want. What always keeps me up at night is to make sure that our team, our staff, continues to grow, to prosper, do well, and what we can do to support it, and the same with our board, because there's such huge demands on them that. We as an organization, what can we do as an organization to be really the place where they feel most loyal to, and will continue to commit their time, their talent, their amazing ideas to the organization. And then the last one that I would say is this, what I sometimes feel like this frantic pace of change. And I know we're in this world, and you feel constantly like, oh, we should do change this and we should change that and so on, and how to really prioritize of what is the most important to focus on right now, because there's change fatigue. And yeah, I think that's a one. If you want to talk about meetings specifically, it's cost, to be honest.
Well, tell us more.
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, I think we've all seen it. Costs have gone up significantly, everything from travel to, you know, what AV costs to what, you know, other services and solutions cost. And the shortage to a degree, actually to a large degree, the shortage of really talented individuals who are working alongside us. I mean, obviously the pandemic has created a huge drain of talent in our industry that I don't think has returned yet. And that has a real impact on the quality, on the cost, on our ability to really execute meetings in the most effective and efficient way.
And can you share any insight of what you're doing about it? Are you reducing your scope? Are you passing the cost on to the registration or the sponsors? How are you managing that?
Well, all of that is obviously sensitive because you need to find the right balance. You don't have a unlimited ability to just change your costs or increase your costs. I think it is a clever management. And again, our team is fantastic at that. And Lisa is leading this wonderfully. It's being smart about what you do and how you do it. And yes, maybe we're going to have to go out and do RFPs a little bit more often to see are we really working with the best partner that gives us the greatest value. At the same time, we tremendously value those partnerships that give us the longevity, that give us the experience, that give us the partnership. I think that's really the main area. We are always looking at how can we diverse revenues so that we are not as reliant on a publication or on a meeting or something else, so that that doesn't hit us quite as much. But yeah, it's a constant balancing act.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that. You mentioned already right at the start in your career that you opted for the association side rather than the meetings and events side. And I kind of, forgive me if I'm wrong, but I understood that was a bit of a stress thing as well, just to keep that sort of energy level, right? Is that something that you have learned how to deal with, the stress side? And maybe do you also help your team deal with stress? Stress always comes through as one of these big concerns of people that run events and meetings, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, look, we are stressed. And I think just what we discussed has actually a huge impact on this. It's a lot of uncertainty. There's change every day. So we're in this constant stage of change and innovation and so on. And that is stressful. And helping your team to manage through this is a key element, and also your board, right, and your other stakeholders, and how you can actually help them make their lives easier. For myself, I have to say, I've learned really to be more open about my own stress and be, call it, vulnerable about this, because myself, and I know many of my colleagues, have felt for the longest time, hey, we're the ones who need to make sure everything works. We're the ones as CEOs. We are the ones who need to control everything and make sure that we're getting through the pandemic and now what's post-pandemic in the best possible way. And look, if we're not looking after ourselves, then that's a real problem. And I think the biggest thing that has helped me is to shed the notion or the illusion that I really can control everything or a lot. And the reality is you probably can only really control a little bit of everything that happens. And so here again, I think I want to circle back around to this aspect of the network and of peers and colleagues and valued partners. It's hugely helpful there to be able to reach out, to talk, to share your worries that you may not want to share maybe with your board or with your staff, at least not in the first place, and get advice and counsel. And not having that would be usually problematic for me.
That's a wonderful message. And I think it's great to just remind ourselves of how important our network of peers and friends really is.
And honestly.
Tom, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you for sharing all this with us. And to finish off, I'd like you to recommend someone else that you think we would like to talk to on our podcast. Like you were just talking about your network of peers, if you could share one of your peers with us, if you could connect us with someone else that you think would have an interesting conversation, we'd really appreciate that.
Yeah, I will absolutely do this. There's so many interesting people that we can learn so much from. I'll give it a little bit of thought and I will let you know. And Miguel, thank you very much for inviting me. I always enjoy our interaction. You are part of that, right? You are one of the peers. You're one of the very valued members of this network that I can reach out to. You hear from me. You always answer my questions or yeah, I really appreciate you and I appreciate what we have here together in our industry.
Thank you very much for those kind words. Once again, Tom, it's been a pleasure. I hope everybody listening enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. See you next week.
Yeah, take care.